Part 3. Divination. 1686. 1. They took up residence in Manhattan on a street called Maiden Lane, not far from Minetta Creek, where the surrounding land was farmed by free men who had once been slaves. Originally called Mag de Page by the Dutch, the street began as a footpath near a stream, where lovers often met and women gathered in the mornings to do laundry. At the most southern end stood the fly market, where fish and vegetables and fruit were sold, a crowded, filthy place where housewives could find anything they might need, and witches could find rare ingredients, such as the bark and berries of the Dracaena Draco, the red resin tree of Morocco and the Canary Islands, if they knew where to look. The house on Maiden Lane was well furnished, with hand-knotted rugs from Persia dyed with indigo and satin curtains. There was white tableware from France and expensive cutlery that had immediately blackened as soon as Maria unpacked it, though every knife and spoon had been marked by the stamp of a fine silversmith in London. There was a yard in which to grow herbs, including tall plumy sage and aromatic rosemary, along with feverfew and wormwood, and currant bushes whose young leaves made a fragrant mixture when lemon zest and rosemary were added, for Maria's travel well tea that helped to prevent scurvy. In the rear of the garden, there was a spiky fence to ensure that children from the neighborhood would not stumble upon certain plants and mistakenly ingest herbs that would make them ill, the darker ingredients such as bittersweet nightshade, foxglove, laurel, castor beans. Samuel's father, Abraham, often sat in the garden on fine days, wishing he were at sea alongside his son. He still had on his leather hat that he'd always worn when sailing. The old fellow was a charming man with a thousand stories, more even than his son. But he had been ailing, and Samuel had purchased the house so that his father could comfortably live out his final years in Manhattan. He'd bought the small manor from the first Jewish resident of New York, Jacob Barciman, who had arrived in the city in 1654, traveling from Amsterdam with the Dutch West India Company. Although Samuel bought the house for his father, he'd chosen it with Maria in mind. Right away, he had a team of workers come to stake out the garden plot and cut down the weeds and nettles that grew wild. And he made certain there was a chamber for Faith, ready when she was found. When they first arrived, Maria had locked herself in her chamber with the grimoire. She attempted every spell that might bring a missing person home. She lit candles, laid out stones and bird feathers on the wooden floor, slit the palms of her hands so that her blood could call out to Faith. She cut up one of Faith's dresses and dropped the fabric into a flame, then added pine needles and marigold flowers, a spell meant to call a person to arrive on your doorstep in less than 24 hours. None of it worked. Try as she might, she could not use the sight to find her daughter. When she gazed into the black mirror, all she saw was a land that seemed to stretch on forever, where hundreds of rabbits gathered, nothing more. During her first weeks in New York, Maria didn't eat or drink or sleep, and she didn't answer when Samuel knocked at the door. Her loss was too enormous. She could not bear to speak to another person. Early in the morning, she sneaked out to search the city streets, hoping that luck would allow her to spy a girl with red hair. In time, she found several, but none were her daughter, and she came home exhausted. After a while, she seemed to give up, and she took to her bed and slept for days, until Diaz woke her and said if nothing else she must drink water, or she would make herself ill. "When she does come back, she will need you alive," he told her. He made adafina, a chicken stew his mother had often served, consisting of chicken, fava beans, onions, chickpeas, garlic, and cumin, and a sponge cake called pan de España, that had been baked by Jews in Spain since the year 1000, often using potatoes instead of flour. When Maria sat down at the table, she realized she was starving. She was still eating her supper long after Abraham had gone up to bed. "Do you think this will win me over?" she asked Samuel Diaz when she was done. The food had been delicious, and he had spent hours making it. He also baked a chocolate cake, using his mother's recipe, a sweet so drenched in rum a single slice could make a person tipsy. For some reason, Maria felt alive again, and guilty that her heart still managed to beat, though it was broken in two. "I don't have to win you over," Diaz shrugged. "I already won." Maria couldn't help but laugh at his arrogance. "That was before. Now there's a curse." "I don't care," Diaz said. "I loved you before there was a curse." They were both stunned by this admission, so they said nothing and ate more, tearing apart oranges from Spain that were fragrant and sweet. Then they discussed their situation and the terms of their living arrangement, including the fact that he must not love her. It was too dangerous to do so. She thought back to the gallows, how she had looked at John Hathorne and set a curse upon anyone who might fall in love with a member of the Owens family. She'd sought to protect herself and her daughter and any of their descendants from the grief she'd known. "You can't be in love with me," Maria told Samuel. "If you insist, I will say that I'm not." The butter in a dish on the table had already begun to melt, a sign that someone in the house was in love. "Why is that happening?" Maria asked when she saw how it melted.
"When it's hot, things melt."
"I see." Maria was burning as well.
"What's love?"
Samuel shrugged.
"You can't hold it in your hand. You can't see it. It's something you feel. Perhaps it's not even real."
He thought his argument was excellent, until Maria laughed at him. "How many women have you told this story to?" she wanted to know. Then Samuel was serious.
"Only you."
With that, he won the argument, and they went up to bed. Maria insisted they make no vows to each other, no contracts of love, no promises, nothing that could call down the curse. Of course, he agreed. He would have agreed to anything in order to have her. When Maria woke the next morning, she gazed at Samuel's broad back as he slept, and she felt something that she couldn't name in the pit of her stomach. Perhaps it was desire, or affection, or perhaps it was more. The thing you couldn't hold in your hand or see with your own eyes, but was there all the same. Whatever it was a mistake. At the age of 10, Maria had vowed never to be in love. She had seen what it had done to Hannah and Rebecca, and the women who arrived late at night, desperate for spells. She'd only been infatuated with John Hathorne, the flirtations of a girl, and there'd been disastrous results. She set stricter limits for herself with Samuel. She would sleep in his bed when he was at home, and she would care for his father when he was at sea, but he must never ask her for more. The problem was they couldn't keep to the rules, and they couldn't keep their hands off each other. They lived like this for nearly a year, their life at night a secret, so that Maria often entirely ignored Samuel during the daylight hours. And then one morning, Maria saw a beetle in the yard and she felt a chill. Upon examination, she found it was not the wretched Death Watch beetle. All the same, she feared for Samuel's safety. She was grieving over Faith, and she didn't think she could survive losing someone else. From then on, she locked her door and didn't answer when she heard Samuel at night. One morning, she found that he had slept in the hall. When she woke him, Samuel stood to face her. It was clear that he was stung by her rejection.
"If you want me to leave, say so," he told Maria. "I'll go now, today."
"This is your house. Are you sure you want me?"
He did, too much, but he didn't respond. That night, she recited an incantation to send love away. The next morning, he packed to leave.
"You shouldn't go away," Abraham told his son. "Life is short and getting shorter. I know you want Maria. Stay with her."
"She won't let me," Samuel continued, packing his bag. "She says we're cursed."
"Everyone is cursed," the old man assured him. "That's life."
He shook his head and thought that young people were fools.
"You might as well do as you please."
Samuel did one thing he knew Maria wouldn't wish him to do. He left a leather pouch on the table. Inside was a sapphire on a silver chain. "This one is real," he'd written in the note he left behind.
"Você não pode fingir algo real não existe."
You can't pretend something real doesn't exist. After Samuel left, Maria and Abraham Diaz settled into the routine of two people in mourning. They comforted each other, for each knew sorrow. Men who were sailors rarely became accustomed to living on land, and Abraham Diaz longed for the life he'd once had. He spent his days waiting for his son, even though Samuel might be gone for months at a time. The old man's memory had begun to fail more each day. Still, he knew that he was in New York, and that he lived in his son's house with a beautiful woman whose name he sometimes forgot, especially in the evenings when Maria returned from searching for Faith and poured him a glass of port. All the same, Abraham shared his stories with her as he sipped his nightly drink. He always remembered these stories, even though he'd often forgotten what he'd had for his supper that very day. He told her about the joy of riding on the back of a whale, the salt spray filling his mouth, and about a land where all the bears were white, and it was so cold the earth was covered with ice even in the heart of August, and about the Barbary Coast, where the leopards and lions would eat beef from the palm of your hand if you had the nerve to reach out to them, and where diamonds glittered up through holes in the earth, as if there were stars not only above but below. The stories that she loved best were when Abraham recounted his son's early days at sea, when the young Samuel was so captivated by the starry heavens above he didn't sleep at night, but instead lay on his back on the deck, memorizing the position of the stars so that he might chart the sky. Abraham Diaz tired easily and went to bed directly after he had his nightly meal, which was just as well. He would have been confused by the women who came to the door in search of remedies once darkness had fallen. He likely would have looked among them for his wife, who had been gone for so long. She had been young and beautiful when he first met her, and he had loved her too much, so much that she still appeared in his dreams, although she had been burned to ash long ago. Her name was Regina, but she was called Reina, for to Abraham she was a queen. Maria had a deep affection for the old man, who had taught her how to make chocolate tipsy cake, and she hated to leave him on his own when she left the house, for he was prone to wander, often finding his way to the rough area of the docks. Once he'd been tied to a post by a gang of unruly boys and left there in the rain, unable to escape from the ropes that bound him until Keeper at last tracked him down and Maria cut him free. From then on, whenever she went to search for her daughter, which was her daily habit, she employed a hired girl named Evelyn to watch him, even though he was annoyed when left in another's care.
"She doesn't give a damn about stories," he would complain about his caretaker, a dull girl who often fell asleep when she was supposed to be watching him. "She's not like you."
"Pretend she's me, and before you know it, I'll be back," Maria said to soothe him. Maria continued to search for Faith, and each time she came home unsuccessful, she turned to the grimoire, also to no effect. She had no idea what thwarted her, making it impossible to locate Faith. She'd begun to think she'd lost the sight. By now, she was known in the neighborhood as the woman with the stolen child,
for she'd gone door to door asking if anyone had seen her daughter. The other mothers pitied her when they saw her in the short black veil she wore when she was in public. She paid informants. But those who said they had seen a red-haired girl in the care of a tall, thin woman were either out of date or inventing sightings in order to collect some silver. Keeper was always beside Maria as she searched farther northward, in the wild area beyond the wall built by the Dutch to keep out native people and pirates and the British. Wall Street, built in 1685, ran beside the ramparts and crossed the old Indian path now called Broadway. Maria trailed the river on the west side, taking the road called Love Lane, a nighttime trysting place, hiking into the highlands where there were still large Dutch farms, and making her way through the woods where some Lenape people remained, hidden in the old forest where the trees were so big it would take 10 men to circle the trunk of a single one. People grew accustomed to seeing Maria and Keeper. Some of those they passed called out a greeting to the purposeful black dog and the woman wearing a veil. But there were those, such as the old farmers who had been among those who settled New York more than 60 years earlier, who recognized the wolf for what it was. The Lenape people did as well, but they called him brother, for they knew that when the Dutch and the English claimed the land, they'd treated Keeper's kind as they had the original people, with the intent to own and destroy. Nothing helped Maria Owens, not even the back pages of the grimoire, which contained those spells from Agrippa and the Key of Solomon, only to be used in the most dire of times. At last she performed an act of desperation. She lay on her back, naked on the floor, inside a pentagram she had drawn with charcoal. She was surrounded by burning candles, a brass bowl of blood and fingernail clippings and strands of hair on fire. She had made a small wax figure of Martha that twisted in the heat. This was left-handed magic, dangerous to one and all. "Use only when you must," Hannah Owens had written in her perfect handwriting. "And know you will pay a price for doing so." There was always a price when magic was used selfishly, for the practitioner's own benefit. But Maria no longer cared. The wax figure was stabbed with a single sharp pin, and the wax shuddered as it dissolved. This was sympathetic magic. Do unto an object what you would wish on an individual. One becomes the other. Ut omnia quae tibi. Take all that you want. Quid enim mihi est meum. Give me what is mine. Maria sat by the window in the early morning light before she went out to search. Perhaps one day Faith would walk up the gravel path. She might return on an ordinary day, whether it be a blue morning in May or a snowy afternoon in the midst of winter. One day, Martha would be the one to disappear. Maria's spell would see to it. And once she did, Faith would find her way to the house on Maiden Lane, where Maria had planted lilacs by the back door. For where there are lilacs, there will always be luck. In the spring of the third year after their departure from Salem, Samuel Diaz returned to Manhattan beset by his old illness. He came back every few months to sleep in the barn, doing his best to ignore Maria. By now they barely spoke, and she missed the man who could not stop talking. This time he said nothing at all. Breakbone fever was the devil inside him, but the disease was his teacher as well, for it reminded him of his own mortality and instructed him in the ways in which men were powerless over their own fates. He arrived in a rented carriage and was helped out by the driver, for he was too weak to navigate the street. Maria had insisted she wanted nothing from him. All the same, she wore the sapphire hidden beneath her collar. She often thought of the other gift he had given her, the magnolia tree in Essex County, that had predicted her freedom. It was a tree of fortune, blooming not in season, but whenever it chose to do so. Even now, in the bitter and austere Massachusetts Bay Colony, where women were being jailed every time a neighbor accused them of hexing sheep and cows or setting a pox on their children with the devil's help, often from miles away while the accused was asleep in her own bed, the magnolia tree had bloomed all winter long. Some people said that it, too, was the work of the devil, but others went to sit beside its flowering boughs, even when there was snow on the ground. No other specimen could compare to this miracle tree, and yet Samuel brought back other trees for Maria every time he returned. Each time he did so, he gave her his heart. The trees did his talking for him now, if only she would listen to what he had to say. He'd given her date palms and bridal bloom, jujube trees called zufzuf, tamarisk, thuja trees, monkey puzzle trees, floss trees, some of which were too delicate for the climate and needed to be kept in pots in the parlor through the winter. Maria never said she was pleased, but he could tell that she was from the look on her face. This time he'd found a specimen on St. Thomas called the Tree of Heaven. He'd gone hiking with some local men to find it, and they'd mocked him for being so love-struck he had been willing to hack through the weeds to get to the perfect sapling. In the spring, the hillsides on St. Thomas turned red as blood, and birds came from northern lands 1,000 miles away to build nests in its branches. Even if it wasn't a miracle tree, it would be one of a kind on the island of Manhattan. Dias appeared more hardened than he had in past years. Now that he commanded the Queen Esther, he was often put in a position where cruelty was the only choice, even for a fair man. There were strands of gray in his coarse black hair, but when he grinned, he still looked like a young man in his 20s, as he was when Maria first met him. As time went on, he discovered that it wasn't that he merely enjoyed talking. He wanted someone to talk to, not the strangers he encountered in foreign lands that he would never see again, not the sailors who drank enough so that they forgot his stories as he was telling them. He wanted someone who truly knew him. He wanted her. When Maria spied him through an open window on the day of his return, she knew something was wrong. She went to meet him without bothering to pull on her boots or close the door behind her. No matter how much she wanted him to stay away, he was the man who had saved her life with a rope trick and had been beside her as her heart broke apart in the second Essex County. She quickly paid the driver and helped Dias into the house. As always, he'd arrived without notice and had no idea how long he would stay. "We weren't expecting you," Maria said to reproach him, worrying over the state he was in. Usually he cared about his appearance, but now his clothes were in disrepair and hung on his frame. He'd lost a good deal of weight, and some of his strength was gone. Still, he was the handsome man whose stories Maria could listen to again and again. His dark hair was tied back with a leather band, and his boots hadn't been cleaned for months. Maria, too, was not at her best. "I'm not at all prepared." She had dirt from the garden under her fingernails, and her hair was in knots. Samuel's fever was raging, and he was still a man who either said too much or said nothing at all. When they went inside, he immediately felt at home, a comfort he experienced only when he visited New York. But it was all too much on this day. Samuel found he needed to take a moment to sit and catch his breath before greeting anyone properly.
"What do we have here?" Abraham Dias said, his voice trembling.
There was a handsome man with dark eyes who seemed exhausted and wore a familiar black coat.
"You look like my son."
"He should," Maria assured the old man. "That's exactly who he is." Samuel gathered his strength and went to embrace his father. The two men were not afraid to show their raw emotions when they were together. They had seen and done terrible things and had worked side by side for a lifetime
until Abraham could no longer stand upright for more than a few minutes at a time without the pain in his back and legs overwhelming him. Age had come upon him quickly, like a thief, and an injury he'd suffered when they first took their ship from a royal merchant and renamed it the Queen Esther had worsened with the years so that he limped and could no longer walk very far. On this day, neither man could stand for long. Abraham could deal with his own failing body, but to see his son in such bad health caused him to weep. "It's that damn fever," Abraham declared. "It won't leave you alone." He turned to Maria, frustrated. "I thought you had cured him."
"I cure him every time. That is the only way to treat this disease. Some things return no matter what, and we must deal with it when it does."
"I'm fine," Samuel insisted. "I can stay in the barn." But Maria insisted he must take the chamber, being saved for Faith's return. Samuel was mortified that she had to help him up the stairs, and yet he wondered if perhaps he had willed the illness to return, if he wanted nothing more than to have her arms around him, despite the price. Everything inside of him hurt, as if his bones were made of glass once more. A single touch was agony, and yet he yearned for Maria's embrace, for glass could burn as well as break. Once in bed, he moaned and turned his face to the wall. He hated to show his weakness. All the same, he hadn't enough strength to take off his boots.
"You should have come home before this," Maria told him. "I can tell you've been ill for a while."
Abraham had a right to falter, but breakbone was a tricky disease that lurked inside a person's body. You chased it away, only to have it return unexpectedly. Samuel found he was comforted by Faith's belongings that were stored in this room. The blanket with the blue stitching, the poppet doll he had made. "There it is," he said, happy to spy the doll. "You've kept it safe."
"Of course I have," Maria answered. "Didn't you tell me I must?"
She went to collect the dried tawatawa leaves that were stored in her herb cabinet so that she might fix a pot of the curative tea. And when she returned, Samuel was already asleep. He was talking as he dreamed, this time about the burning of his mother. The prisoners had been dressed in sackcloth, with dragons and flames painted upon their shirts and hats. They had ropes around their necks and were forced to carry rosary beads and green and yellow candles. Dias was haunted by the shocking scene he had witnessed as a boy, and in his dreams he often revisited the square where it had occurred. The smoke that arose from the burning bodies was bloody and bitter. He could hear his mother's voice ringing through a crowd of 1,000. Maria removed his boots and slipped into bed beside him so that she might hold a cold, wet cloth to his head. She reached under his shirt to find that he was burning, his heart red hot. "Don't leave me," he said, convinced it was she who was the true remedy, not the bitter tea she insisted he drink, or the broth she made for him out of fish bones to keep him strong. At first, Maria thought he was speaking to his mother in his dreams, until he embraced her and called her by her name. This was what happened every time he was home. If she kissed him once, she would not stop. It was wrong, and she knew it. It was dangerous as well. She spoke both to him and to the curse. "Don't say any more. And do not speak of love. This is not love. This is something else. It's my life twined together with yours. You are only home because you are ill, not because you look at me the way you do. You must go away as soon as you can, far across the sea, where you will be safe. This is a dream. It isn't real. It won't affect you. I will never be yours." Samuel Diaz tore at his clothes, and Maria helped him. He was burning, and so was she. The broth on the bedside table would wait. The world could wait as well. Outside, rain had begun to fall. Maiden Lane was silent and green, but nothing outside this chamber mattered. Soon the quilt began to burn, and they tossed it away.
The city had grown so small it only included one room. Samuel kept his eyes open so that he could see Maria at all times. The world was her, and her alone. He remembered the way she had leapt from the gallows, her eyes meeting his as he waited in the trees with his heart in his mouth, praying the rope was frayed properly so that the jute would split apart. The world ended and began when it did.
"Do you know how much I wanted you, still want you, will always want you?" In the small bed, in the room under the eaves, she told him he must not love her. "If you want to live," Maria said, "you must stay away from me. That's why I always tell you to leave."
"That's the only reason?"
"You're very annoying. It's true."
They both laughed. "As are you," he said, his arms around her.
He was convinced what they did didn't matter. He was ruined already. What sort of curse could be worse than the way he'd been cursed on that burning day in Portugal? Let his life be over, if it must be. Let the last thing he see be the rain on the window glass, the white plaster walls, Maria's black hair falling over her shoulders, the line of daybreak over Manhattan, a sky that was the purest cobalt blue, the blue of heaven, which no matter what they might wish or what they might do, signified the end of a night of love.
The old man knew about them. He often didn't remember what year it was or what country he was in, but certain things were unmistakable and unforgettable. The sounds of love, for instance, were obvious. He heard them at night and was glad that his son could find pleasure in this cruel world. Now Maria was late to breakfast, and Abraham chuckled to think of the reason. He was sitting at the table, having managed to get himself down the stairs. The black dog and he were both waiting to be fed. They were patient, even though the hour for breakfast had long passed and their stomachs grumbled. On most days, Maria was awake long before the old man rose from bed, while the morning was still dark. But today the sun had been up for hours, and the old man and the wolf were still waiting. When Maria finally came downstairs, she was wearing her black dress, neatly buttoned. She had taken the time to comb the tangles from her hair, and she had washed her face with black soap. She looked refreshed, even though she'd barely slept.
"I thought I heard something last night," Abraham said when Maria finally came downstairs. "Very late, when people should be asleep."
"You heard nothing," Maria insisted as she boiled water for Abraham's tea. Abraham Diaz liked his tea strong, with a slice of lemon, when Maria managed to find one of those precious citrus fruits at the market stands.
"I know what I heard. Maybe now he'll stay."
The old man always had bread and butter in the morning, which Maria set before him. Keeper was fed a portion of meat and bones. "He won't."
"New York would be good for him," the old man insisted.
By now, Samuel Diaz was a wealthy man and could easily turn his attentions to another line of work, one that was within the realm of the law. He could import rum from Curacao or bolts of silk from France. He could find himself a warehouse and an office nearby if he lived on Maiden Lane.
"If he were here, you'd know when he was coming down with the fever. He'd be in your care."
Maria threw Abraham a look. "That won't happen," she assured him, brewing herself a cup of release-me tea, a mixture that loosened love's hold on a person, especially when combined with bitters and fresh radish root.
"He could be convinced," Abraham said, "especially if you help me do so."
In Abraham Diaz's opinion, if a man had to live on land, there was no better choice than Manhattan. Portuguese Jews from Brazil had come in 1654, when Portugal reclaimed Brazil from the Dutch, bringing the Inquisition with them. These original Portugals were greeted by Governor Peter Stuyvesant,
who had been unwilling to accept the group of 23 souls with no country and no home, until he was pressured to do so by the original owner of the house on Maiden Lane, Jacob Barseman, who had worked for the Dutch West India Company. The new immigrants were not allowed to build a synagogue, but the men met daily, and Abraham Diaz had gone to these gatherings on Friday evenings in a small house near the harbor. In 1655, Jewish taxpayers had paid for nearly 10% of the price to build the wall, later the site of Wall Street, to separate the city from the wilderness beyond. Although they were outsiders, Jews were watchmakers, tailors, butchers, importers of rum and chocolate and cocoa. Manhattan was a tolerant city, and if you didn't provoke your neighbors or call attention to yourself, you could do as you pleased and worship as you liked. "Let your son be who he is," Maria told Abraham. "A man who lives at sea."
"A man can change," Abraham Diaz assured her.
After all, he was about to plant vegetables in the garden, his hands deep in the earth, which, at this late date, he found to be an unexpected pleasure. Maria went to the North River on the west side of the city to buy haddock and cod so she might simmer a broth of fish bones for Samuel's supper to strengthen his constitution. He had been healing all through the month of his recovery and was much improved. In the afternoons, he sat in the garden with his father in the pale green sunlight, listening to stories he'd heard dozens of times before, and enjoying each one. He'd recently helped his father put in a row of lettuce, which distressed Maria. Why would Samuel bother with planting vegetables when he wouldn't be there to see them grow? She predicted he would be gone by the end of the week, and once away from her, he would be safe. The Queen Esther was docked, and it was likely most of the crew had begun to run out of funds and would soon be ready to be back at sea. If Maria wasn't mistaken, she could see a flicker of longing for the sea in Samuel's eyes when the wind picked up and the sea chilled the air, a hunger for his old life in which he didn't have to sit at the dinner table at an appointed hour, here where the stars weren't half as bright as they were out at sea. He was drawn to the harbor, where he stared out beyond Hellgate. New York was blue and gray, a city surrounded by water, which called to him even though he wished to stay. The broad North River, later to be renamed the Hudson, ran two ways. Seawater rushed to the north. Fresh water flowed into the ocean. It was a river that couldn't make up its mind, and Samuel appreciated that. He was born under the sign of water, and was himself often of two minds. He yearned to leave, and he didn't want to go. He had recently constructed a boat out of parchment by folding it this way and that for Maria's amusement. Men on ships found all sorts of entertainments to while away the hours at sea. How to make a valentine out of shells, how to turn paper into cranes and birds and fish and boats, how to tell stories, how to be completely silent. When Maria set the paper boat in the river, it had turned one way and then the other. In the end, it did not set forth on either tide, north or south, but instead continued on in a circle until Samuel plucked it from the sea. It was a sign of his own indecision. On some mornings he packed his bag, on others he could not imagine ever leaving New York. At the fly market, on the far end of Maiden Lane, Maria noticed a person of interest farther down the row of stalls, buying lemons at the fruit stand. The shopper was an elegant woman who wore an embroidered mauve dress stitched in France. Her pale hair was caught up with small combs, all of which were blackened silver. A small white dog followed at her feet, devoted beyond all reason. If Maria wasn't mistaken, the woman wore red boots. "I wouldn't look at Miss Durant for too long," the fishmonger warned Maria as he weighed out haddock. "It wouldn't be wise."
"Why is that?"
Maria wore a black veil over her face whenever she was in public. On the day when she finally found her daughter, she would throw the veil away, or burn it over a pile of sticks, or tear it to shreds. For now, it had its desired effect. People steered clear and avoided her, for no one wished to step too close to tragedy. And yet, there were still those who took pity on her. The fishmonger among them, for she was unmistakably a woman in mourning. "Catherine Durant is an enchantress," the fishmonger confided in a low tone as he nodded to the other shopper. "You might call her a witch."
"Is she?"
Maria craned her neck to see, for the woman they spoke of was already leaving, her back turned to them. Her little dog gazed at Maria with bright eyes before hurrying after his mistress.
"I sold her fish she said wasn't fresh, and for the next 2 months I didn't sell another thing," the fishmonger went on. "Not a scrap or an ounce. People walked by as if I was invisible, and those who saw me held their noses as if my wares stank. So I had a bushel of mussels delivered to her house, and after that, it was business as usual. Now I send a gift of mussels or clams to her on the first of every month. It's worked out well for both of us."
Maria soon made her way to the fruit vendor, but before she could choose any of the produce, he handed her a satchel. "Sir," Maria said, surprised by his forwardness, "I don't yet know what I want."
"It doesn't matter. She knows." He nodded in the direction of which the woman had disappeared. The vendor looked sheepish, but when a witch suggested you do something, it was best to comply.
Inside the satchel were 10 apples, already paid for, shiny red.
"She said to bake a pie."
"Did she?" Despite herself, Maria smiled. Someone had seen her for who she was, most likely a sister in the nameless art.
"She said you wouldn't regret it, and to bake one every week and set it on your windowsill."
If this was magic, it was made of simple, practical stuff. All the same, Maria went home and cut up the apples, then made a crust. She rolled out the dough, and when she added the apples to the mix, the white slices turned crimson. Perhaps the fruit was not as ordinary as she had first thought. She felt her hopes rise as the pie baked in the brick oven beside the fireplace, as she sent a message to Faith, wherever she might be. "Do what you must until we are together again, but never believe a word she tells you. Believe only in yourself. You are my daughter, and mine alone, whether we are together or apart." When the pie was done, Maria let it cool on the windowsill. It sat there, red as a heart, the crust brown, perfectly done. From then on, she baked a pie each and every week, with apples that turned from white to red. People passing by sniffed the fragrant air and were reminded of home, and many longed to find their way back to their loved ones. That was all Maria wished for. That was all she wanted in the world, to look out her window and see her darling girl, to have her walk up the stone path and fling open the door. Two. In a place called Kings County, originally called Brooklyn by the first Dutch settlers, newcomers arrived to find a land of marshes dotted by snow-white clouds, where the horizon reached out in bands of blue until at last it met with the sea. This lowland had reminded the Dutch of home, and many had sunk to their knees and wept upon their arrival in this wild place, where the sky was filled with ducks and geese, and fish jumped in the streams. Rough workingmen, both farmers and fishermen, established the original villages on land, where the native Lenape people had once lived, before they were slaughtered and driven out, first by the Dutch, then by the British who replaced the original invaders. In a world that had begun with murder, there was always cruelty, despite the beauty of the shore and the sea. There were 5 towns originated by the Dutch in the county, and the 6th, Gravesend, was populated by those who wished to disappear from their previous lives. It was built in 1645 on a parcel of land originally belonging to Lady Deborah Moody and her son, Sir Henry, both of whom had fled from the Puritans of the Massachusetts Bay Colony in search of religious freedom. Lady Moody had been fortunate enough to have the crown grant her a small wedge of King's County. She'd begun her life in England, close to royal life, and had happily ended her time on earth in Brooklyn, where she'd been free to do as she pleased and had been buried in the one cemetery at the end of an Indian path. Her son had disappeared. Some people said he'd been buried beside his mother. Others vowed he'd left for the unknown territories in the West and that he preferred native people to Englishmen. The original settlement had been destroyed by the war-ravaged native population, who had lost more than 1,000 to the Dutch aggression and hundreds more to the British, though they did their best to fight back. In the end, they were defeated, and their population had all but vanished. When Faith was brought to Gravesend, it was the farthest outpost of what was called the Flat Country, by detractors and admirers alike, populated by hardy souls who did not fear isolation. Martha Chase paid a pittance to the village elders for the use of an abandoned house overgrown by weeds and vines. She wished to be in a place that was on very few maps, and the farther she was from the crowds of Manhattan, the better. For all the previous year, there had been an epidemic of yellow fever, which had killed 10% of the population. Gravesend was cold in the dead of winter, with ice coating the cattails and reeds. And it was equally hot in the blazing summer when the sun beat down. Their house was far enough from the village so that hundreds of gulls and terns wheeled across the sky all through the day, and not another sound was heard. It was a worthwhile spot, for they could fish in the streams and have a garden, though the sandy soil was a trial. It was easy enough to hide away in this desolate location, where there would be few questions asked concerning the girl, and her hair dyed pitch black from a tint of crushed inkberries and the boiled bark of a black walnut tree, a quiet, thoughtful child who didn't resemble the pale, nervous woman who insisted Faith call her mother. When Faith repeatedly told her she already had a mother, Martha Chase calmly said that Maria hadn't wanted her and had given her to Martha. Otherwise, she would have been in a workhouse. Faith wept at night. When she looked at the inky sky, she wished for a sign that her mother still loved her, in her dreams or in her waking life, which would let her know her mother was still thinking of her. By the time they had arrived, Brooklyn was populated by 2,000 souls, and although it was set just across the river from Manhattan, it was a world away. When they'd first left Massachusetts, Faith had been told there were evil people who were chasing after her, and that they must escape or the devil would have them. Faith's mother would approve of their move to New York, the girl was told. After all, she had given her only child to Martha for her protection. And wasn't that proof of her wishes? Faith might be in disguise, but she was who she was, and her natural inclinations arose time and time again. When she closed her eyes and sang a song in a language Martha had never before heard, a soft green rain would begin. When she whistled, sparrows came to sit in the palm of her hand. She could foretell storms and sunny weather, light a candle with her breath, find drinking water merely by following its scent. And Martha once heard her speaking to her mother, asking Maria to please come and find her. Martha had heard that there were ways of curbing magic, and that witches had an aversion to iron, for it took away the sight and was the element that decreased their powers. After Faith picked a flower that bloomed in the palm of her hand out of season as she stood in the snow, Martha had a blacksmith come to solder iron bracelets around Faith's wrists. It was costly, but worth it as far as Martha was concerned. In a proper, pious household, any form of blasphemy could not be allowed.
"This is so I can always find you," Martha had said, to comfort Faith when the torch stung, but the truth was she wanted to make certain that Faith would not escape.
After the bracelets had been locked onto her wrists, Faith felt a pale dullness inside of her. She could no longer call birds to her, or see what was to come. She could not make the clouds move or ask the sky to rain. When she dipped her hands in the streams, the fish swam away from her. She was a prisoner, without talent, without hope. But at night, she was free to dream. And in her dreams, she saw her mother crying as she stood beside a flowering tree. That was how Faith knew that her mother was still alive. She hadn't been forgotten. They had traveled constantly at first, living in Lower Manhattan, then on a farm in the settlement of Bergen in New Jersey, a place plagued by mosquitoes and lawlessness. Wherever they went, the door was always kept bolted to ensure that none of the bad people from Massachusetts would snatch the child. Who these bad people were, Faith had no idea, for all she could remember was a loving mother, a man who told stories when she was little more than a babe, and a black dog that followed her faithfully. And yet she was told they must always remain in disguise to protect themselves. Martha called herself Olive Porter, and Faith had a new name each time they moved, even though changing a person's name was known to bring bad luck. She had been called Temperance, Charity, Patience, Thankful, and Verity. When she was alone, she wrote down these names in black ink, then crossed them out with thick, blotchy lines, as if doing so could block out her false identities. At last they had come to Kings County, where the blue air tasted like salt and seabirds dropped clams onto the dirt roads to crack them open to feast upon. It was the last outpost and the place where they would stay. As always, Faith was made to call the lady who took care of her, Mother. The word continued to stick in her throat. She was certain that if she waited long enough, her true mother would find her, and that one bright morning when she opened her eyes, Maria Owens would be there. Faith had turned 9 when they first came to settle in Gravesend, the land of seabirds and outcasts. There were few outsiders who passed through this place, and most residents who abided here had reasons to be in a town that seemed to be perched at the end of the earth. There were husbands who had quit their wives, and women who'd been cast out, and robbers who were tired of running from the law. "We'll be safe here," Martha told Faith, although safe from what, Faith wasn't quite sure. She was now called Comfort, a name she despised, not that there were many to call her by name. Quiet was a certainty here, and it was possible to be alone for weeks on end, whether one was walking along the dirt roads or through the sandy fields. Other than the changes in the weather, each day was the same as the one before, and the one to come. People in town waited for the peddler, who appeared on the last Friday of the month, and all were excited to see an outsider. They went to him for bolts of fabric or nails or pots and pans, and would have to go without until he appeared, for no storekeeper had found the courage to open shop in this remote location. Faith Owens could spy the sea from her room in the attic, where the previous tenant had died of the fevers, for in this low-lying land there were clouds of mosquitoes drifting by on summer nights. One out of every 3 children born out here would be dead before a first birthday was celebrated, and several of the women in town wore mourning black no matter the year or the season. As the years passed, Faith had more questions all the time, but because she dared not ask, they went unanswered. If Maria was alive, why hadn't she come after her? Where was her loyal wolf dog?
who would never leave her side of his own volition. Why must Faith not show the true color of her hair? Ever since that day when the constables came to call in Essex County, her life had been torn in two. There was the before, when she'd lived with her mother, and the after, the time that had accrued ever since Martha had taken her aboard the ship bound for New York, leading to these years in Brooklyn. Faith often walked to the end of the old Indian path, which led past the cemetery. She left seashells to decorate Lady Moody's grave, for she felt this Englishwoman, who had made her way in this wilderness, to be a kindred spirit. On the shortest night of the year, she left the house after dark, when there were only patches of silvery light slipping through the clouds. She brought along a white candle to honor the town's founder. Never hide who you are inside, she'd always been told. But all that she was had been hidden, even from herself. By now, Faith understood that she was living a lie. Over the years, she had slowly gained her foster mother's trust. She was always well-behaved and did as she was told without complaint. She didn't talk back, and when they went into town on the day the peddler came, she knew well enough not to talk to strangers. Martha Chase told Faith that she was the perfect child, and if being perfect meant she could see into Martha's bitter heart and know she was deceitful, then perfect was what she was. By the time she turned 11, Martha agreed to let Faith be called Jane, a simple name Faith far preferred over Comfort, which made her feel as if she were a blanket or an old dog. In time, Faith was allowed to wander the beaches, and even to go into the village on the last Friday of the month, when the wagon came to town. She stole pennies from Martha and bought a hand mirror from the peddler, an affable English fellow named Jack Finney, a modest individual who had few attachments in the world and wore a shabby blue jacket and boots that were too large for his feet. Faith asked if she might have a bit of black paint, which she used to coat the glass. And when the paint dried, she peered into the dark mirror. There was her mother, in a black dress, crying in the night. There was her dog, standing at the gate. She dreamed that her mother spoke to her. "Do what you must until we are together again, but never believe a word she tells you. Believe only in yourself. You are my daughter, and mine alone, whether we are together or apart." Whenever she could, Faith did as she pleased. She bought old water-stained volumes from the peddler, and she could often be spied with her parcels, walking the lanes while reading a book, which she made sure to hide before Martha Chase could catch her. As far as Martha was concerned, one learned to read only to have access to the scriptures. All other reading was the devil's work, inflaming men's imaginations with stories that weren't true, and ideas that could lead a reader to a path of rebellion. A streak of independence and a curious mind meant trouble. In Martha's opinion, a woman who spent her time reading was no better than a witch. Martha Chase believed in evil. She was absolutely certain that it walked alongside them every day, on the road and in the fields, tempting them to leave the grace of the Lord. Witchery was a brand of wickedness Martha had hoped they'd escaped when they left Massachusetts, for in that colony witches were born and bred. She would have been stunned to know that Faith climbed out her window at night to go to the graveyard. Faith had set up a kettle in order to make the black soap her mother had been known for. She bought or pilfered ingredients that she remembered as useful from the time that she'd watched Maria practice the nameless art. Ginger, lemon, salt, the bark of the elm, chokeberries, cherry pits, white candles and black candles, black fabric, red thread, blue beads, feathers, wild belladonna, which was dangerous and agitated the spirit, bright yellow-green ferns, for lightning never strikes where ferns grow. She'd begun to trade her soap for books and herbs, and Finney, the peddler, said every woman who bought a bar of the fragrant black soap had returned to beg for more.
On Saturdays, Faith sat with Martha to read from the Geneva Bible, the scriptures that formed all Puritan beliefs. She always washed her hands and face before they read, so as not to smudge the pages. In Martha's eyes, Brooklyn was a land of disbelievers, where all denominations other than Quakers were welcome to own land. There were Dutch Reformed Protestants, and some Catholics, and even, some people said, a few Jewish families from Amsterdam. It was a free and wild place compared to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and one had to keep watch at all times to remain on the narrow path.